things at the end of the service today. Okay, let's turn to Psalm chapter 3, please. Psalm chapter 3, verse 3. I want you to imagine that you are a king of a nation, people group, large people group, very influential person. And I want you to imagine that things are going well, seemingly well. You're doing what kings do, queens do, whatever your case may be. And then you're overthrown. Your government is overthrown, your power is diluted, and you're chased out of town. Not only are you chased out of town, you're chased out of town, nobody wants to be with you because you have a bullseye on your head. And not only that, you're being pursued by armies of people, thousands of people. What do you do? I mean, one day you had it going on, and the next day you've got serious problems on your hands. Now, imagine that all of that happened, and not only did it happen, but the person who overthrew your government, forced you out of town, and is pursuing you, is your son. Man, it just got worse. In 2 Samuel chapter 15 through 18, you read this soap opera unfolding of this incredible crisis in the life of King David, whereby his son Absalom has chased him out of Jerusalem, down through the Kidron Valley, out of town into the desert. And there you are. Your life has been turned upside down abruptly, and you find yourself not only alone, worse, lonely. So you do what only you do best. You go back to the simplicity of when you were a boy, and you pull out your pen and you write a song. And you call it Psalm 3. That's the context in which we're going to read this scripture this morning. A dysfunctional family, a mess on his hands, being pursued and likely to be killed by his own son, who conspired to overthrow his own father for years. And we see this in verse 3. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and the lifter of mine head. Wow. What kind of statement is that? But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and the lifter of mine head. What words? But, you know, I don't know. We all go through this, and it's inevitable, and you live long enough, you're going to deal with, you know, trauma, drama, crisis, this, that, and the other thing. Some of it's self-induced, others just circumstances that just are part of the human dilemma. You're going to go through issues. I don't know about you, maybe you're like, I'm starting to get, is your giddy up, got up and went? Are some of you having trouble turning around and looking behind you when you back up your car? Is your neck not quite as nimble as it used to be? Are you young and confused and trying to figure out what's going on? What's happening? Well, just part of living on this globe, this sphere here, it's called the human dilemma. And none of us are immune from it. But as bad as it is sometimes, as the swirl in your mind in the middle of the night starts to take on a life of its own and your anxiety wells up and you're just kind of overwhelmed with it, you're exhausted, you're frayed, you're just looking for some kind of rest. David says, but. Like, okay, I acknowledge that. I'm not denying it. I'm not rationalizing. I'm not excusing it. It stinks. It's like a skunk. You ever pass a skunk on the road? Sometimes it lasts for like, the funk lasts for like an eighth of a mile, right? It's potent. I mean, with the windows up and the air conditioning on, it's nasty. Sometimes life is like that, and that's what it is for him. He doesn't deny it. Okay, it is what it is. But he says, but. Okay. There is something else going on at the same time. There is another reality. There is a reality that actually is in the mess, outside the mess, and can get me through the mess and avoid a similar mess in the future. It's a but. And who is it? It's the Lord. But thou, O Lord. You. But you. You exist. I know that. You know, sometimes people get to the point where if things aren't going well, they deny the existence of God, or they confuse themselves about the existence and reality of God, or they dismiss the existence of God. Not David, he says, but, okay, I got something. I got a card I've held back up my sleeve, but the Lord. You are. He is. He's always been. He's not taken off guard by your situation. He's always been. He's not confused by it. He's not bewildered by it. He doesn't have some, I have no idea how to help this person. No, he's in. He has already done this. He's made provision. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me. Some of you old school King James people have that word buckler. Man, I don't use that word anymore. Let's bring that word back. He's a buckler. What's a buckler? A buckler is a shield, but it's a small shield. And sometimes it's on your hand. And sometimes it's on your forearm. Kind of a Wonder Woman kind of thing, you know? Buckler. You got a buckler. He's a buckler. What does that mean? It's a small shield. It's not a big shield. It's not going to protect your vital organs. But it's small enough. And why do you need a small shield? Why do you need a buckler? Why does David need a buckler? And why is he thinking about it? Because the buckler is used for close proximity with an opposition. It's not the thing you're going to hide behind in Braveheart when the arrows come flying, but it is something you're going to use when you're up in someone's grill and you need to hit them in the face, a buckler. It is a shield, and it is the first to incur the advancing of an enemy or a trauma, but it's all you need in that moment. He says, but thou, O Lord, art a buckler, a shield for me. It's a Hebrew word that's kind of likened to, check this out, the scaly skin of a crocodile. Protective, waterproof, drama-proof. Oh, I wish that people had drama-proof bucklers. My life would be so much easier. Your shield, he says. All right. Now, this is funny. God can be a small shield, kind of like graceware, jewelry. God can be a small shield against a vast army. David realizes that's all he needs. He doesn't need a big honking shield. He says, no, if it's God and he's going to be that for me, I don't need it to be big. I just need it to be small, like on my wrist. Something on the front line that takes the brunt of everything coming at me. He says, but thou, O Lord, art a shield. My glory. What? Yet my glory. What does he mean, my glory? Here's a man who's probably hiding in a pile of leaves in the desert. Embarrassed, ashamed. Gotta be wondering about his parenting skills at this point. And he's being pursued by this knucklehead son of his. He says, you are my glory. How does a man get to a point in his life where he can say that earnestly? You are my glory. I can speak for what it's like to be a man, because I'm very macho. I'm a macho man. Let's face it, I'm a very masculine man in my own mind. But there's something about a man that's goofy, but at the same time, it's noble. What is it? I don't know what it is. A man is hardwired. For what? To pursue something glorious, like, have you picked up on the fact I'm a visionary? Have you picked up on this after 9 years? I guess you have. Men like to pursue things that are noble and glorious and big and meaningful. Well, how do men normally do that? Well, outside of the butt, the Lord, you could do that in a lot of different ways. You could do that by being a good dude. Philanthropy is another one. Generosity, helping people, making money, providing for your family. These are all noble pursuits, wonderful things. Popularity, celebrity, influence, leadership. Oh my gosh, I get 100 emails a day on how to be a better leader. I can tell you how you could be a better leader. Don't read the 100 emails a day. It's wasting my time. But we want something noble in life, and I think we want glory. And I think that's the God in us. That's the eternity that God has put in us as men to want to do something substantial with our lives. And I think it's true of women as well. Oftentimes they're in two different venues, but nonetheless, it's a glory. And there's nothing, don't get too wigged out about it. We want to do something glorious with our life. But David, who has every reason to think that he's, you know, has accomplished that. He was the king. He had butlers and servants and a palace nicer than God's house. He had the glory of man. But now he's realizing as he's writing down the lyrics, No, God is my glory. I'll tell you how this word works. It means weighty. Okay, if you've never been on a threshing floor before, you probably never will be. But nonetheless, here's what happens. You take your grain from the harvest, you put it in a pile, you have this big heavy stone over it, you crack the outer kernels of the wheat and the barley, and then when in the afternoon when it's windy, you take a pitchfork and you throw it up in the air, the wind blows through the barn, and guess what? The chaff goes out this way, and that which is weighty, that which is substantial, that which is what you want to keep falls to the ground. There's some weightiness to glory in life. Hey, listen, what have you done in your life? What will you do in your life that has weightiness that will last beyond your life? What weightiness exists in your life that will outlive you in terms of your children or your business? What legacy? See, this is what he's thinking about. He says, no, God, you're my glory. The glory of men, fleeting, fickle. What's your source of glory? Or should I say, who is your source of glory? I would much rather have the opportunity to do a funeral of a man or a woman who lived a simple, quiet, humble, earnest, and authentic life than the pomp and circumstance of someone who's lived for the glory of man. David said, no, you're my glory. Wow, that's a quick revelation in the midst of this crisis. He's come to this quickly. Must be important. He says, but thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my buckler. And he says, you are also my glory. What are you seeking? You're seeking first the kingdom. You're moving towards pretty good glory, pretty weighty glory, pretty substantial, lasting glory. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory and... And that's the thing with God. I've learned this over the last, I don't know. I accepted the Lord in 1987. I'm finally picking up on this. There's always an and with him. There's always this celebration of sufficiency of something that you have in a relationship with him. But it's never all there is. There's always an and. There's always a next thing. There's always a new dimension, a new perspective, a new depth, a new weightiness, a new purpose, a new meaning, new joy, new laughter. He's inexhaustible. He just keeps, like, blowing you away. And David sees that. He says, you're a shield, yeah, and you're my glory, and. And he says, you're the lifter of my head. This is interesting. We have some phrases in our culture that we throw around a lot. And oftentimes we say, they don't mean anything anymore, but oftentimes we say them because it seems to me like the only thing you can really say in a situation. Like, you ever get in those situations where you're like dumbfounded? Like, I don't know what to say. So what do you say? Well, you say something along the lines, well, keep your chin up. Oh, thanks. That's it. Why didn't I think of that? Keep your chin up. Everything's fine. Why am I so downcast? Well, you said, don't be so downcast. Pull yourself up by the bootstraps. Yeah, that's it. Someone wants to make a counseling appointment at the church to come see Pastor Gary. Come in the office and they say, well, just keep your chin up. Oh, thank you so much. That's perfect. That is so substantial. Oh, how wise. Well, just pull yourself by the bootstraps. You're going to be all right. Well, you're down, but not out. Get back up. So knock you down, get back up. Oh, yeah, thanks. What a joke. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. David's not the lifter of his head. David doesn't manufacture in his own personal psyche ways to overcome the drama and the trauma in his life. In fact, you could change the circumstances of his life in the desert. He could out there and find a job and be wonderful. He could raise a whole new family. Who knows? He could start a business and become a millionaire in the desert. His son would still be looking for him, and that'd still be unresolved, and it'd still be an issue in his life, and he'd still think about it at 3:00 in the morning. He can't lift his circumstances up. He can't lift his emotions up. He can't lift his mind up or pull himself up or explain away anything or pat himself on the back enough to actually have some sort of contentment. No, God is the lifter of our head. Do you want to have someone become burnout, fried, exhausted with life? Give them a responsibility constantly of their emotional state. Apart from a God whose job it is to be the lifter of their head. And you'll find someone at the end of their life with a plastic smile on their face where everything's fine, but underneath there's turmoil. Because God is the lifter of our head, primarily. So let's talk about that. Why wouldn't David be able to understand, or how is he able to understand that he's not the lifter of his own head? Well, there's a lot of reasons, and they're not hard to figure out. David's pretty much in touch with his own sin, his own shortcomings, his own weaknesses. Man, I'm a lousy father. I really messed up. Let me take inventory here. I have a daughter who was accosted by my other son, and the son who just overthrew me in government is trying to actually kill him. I was king a few minutes ago. Now I'm in the desert. Boy, I may have failed miserably at this, but if you go to Israel today, I guess what? You're going to see the star of who? David. His life was out of balance. Something wasn't right. And you know what? He can't. He realizes because he knows his own shortcomings. And by the way, if you don't know your own shortcomings, you're in trouble. Because he knows his own shortcomings, he knows he can't lift his own head. Would you want to hire you to run the rest of your life in comparison to the lifter of your head who applied for the job 2,000 years ago and knows all things? Sometimes we have a self-defined unworthiness and untouchability. And we convince ourselves sometimes, or the people that you're doing life with, or the people that you minister to in this community, they have decided that they are not accepting enough or worthy of God's intervention in their life. They have decided that. And now they are the lifter of their head, or they will find something that will lift their head, be it another relationship, another marriage, self-medicating, making more money, going here, going there, running from this, running from that, buying another house over here. Whatever the case may be, we have resigned ourselves to the fact that we realize we have to be the lifter of our own head because God wouldn't lift our head. We're too messed up. A lot of people are like that. Or they get to the point where they say, well, you know, I've kind of fallen that far. What's a little bit further? I know that. I know that logic. I've come this far. I've done this much damage. Why don't I just go a little bit further? It's not going to make that much difference. I'll be the lifter of my own head. God doesn't want anything to do with me anyway. That's true of people. It's not that God is not able. It's much worse. People convince themselves that God is unwilling to intervene in their life. What a dangerous place to be. That there's a God with all the answers. There's a God that demonstrated a love for us. There's a God that wants to intervene in our life, but guess what? He's not really willing. Why? Because I'm not really up to snuff. What a horrible place to be. Yeah, then you would have to put upon yourself the responsibility to be the lifter of your own head. That's got to be exhausting. There's two equally toxic perspectives regarding God's intervention in our emotional life. One is the haughty, snooty person who does everything right, the well-doer, who is deserving of God. In their own mind, they're deserving of God's intervention because they earned it, and they're wrong. Then there's the person on the bottom of the totem pole that's a worthless sinner, is thus undeserving, and God's not going to mess with them either. They're both wrong. God's no respecter of men and shows no favoritism. There's not a pit deep enough to keep God out of your life. If God's not intricately involved in what's going on in your mind, your will, your emotions, your soul, your family, your marriage, whatever it is, if he's not involved in some areas of your life, it's only because you haven't invited him into them, or you don't want him in there, or someone doesn't want him in there. That's the way that works. There is not a pit deep enough. There's not a wastefulness. There's not a wastefulness that's gone on long enough to keep God from you. If you have wasted a lot of your life, and you know it deep down in your soul, you say to yourself, I have not taken advantage of the opportunities that I've been afforded, the gifts, the provision, the insight, the clarity, the relationships, the coaches, the mentors. And you say to yourself, you know what? I didn't do what I needed to do with what I had. And now you find yourself at a season of life. You're going, oh, man, that can't please God. That's not cool at all. I don't know that he's going to get involved with me now. You're wrong. There's not a wastefulness grievous enough for him to stay away from you. There's not a loathing that you have for another, a loathing that you have for him, or a loathing that you have for a circumstance that would keep him away from you. He's the lifter of your head. He's a buckler, a shield for you. He's interested in protecting you, but he's also interested in lifting your head. There's not a loss so deep, and there's not a loneliness so permeating your mind in the middle of the night. When you get into that bed at night and your loved one is no longer with you, and you know that you are all alone, there's not a loneliness potent enough to keep him out of your life. There's not a tradition meaningful enough and repetitive enough and drilled into you long enough to keep you from seeing him in a new light. He's the lifter of your head. There's not an addiction destructive enough. There's not a relationship toxic enough. There's not an atheism and a self-defined atheism real enough to anyone that he cannot permeate that. There is not one, no, I mean not one sinful enough to negate the love of God if you call on his name. Has to be that way. He has to have died for all mankind. He has to have afforded every person, no matter how evil, how destructive, how murderous, to call on his name. Because he's given us all free will to do so. We find ourselves dealing with trauma that we never expected. We didn't expect it soon. And now we got to deal with it. Luke 21 and 28 says, "Now when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads because your redemption draws near." What does this mean? When what things begin to happen? Oh, I don't know. Habitual, repetitive lawlessness, as the Bible talks about. Repetitive alerts on your cell phone of another shooting, another officer killed in the line of duty. Another moral failure in positions of authority. And the bar comes lower and lower and lower, and we become more accepting and expectant of a lower and lower and lower standard. When these things begin to happen, look up. In my short life, I've never seen a time more intense with violence, rage, inexplicable terrorism here and abroad. I've never seen that. As if no laws exist, there is no deterrent, nothing stopping anyone from doing anything they want to do when they want to do it. No check, no conscience. No empathy. Just rage. Rage. In the middle of it all, they realize they can't lift their own head. They look down. They don't look up. They look down in their own wherewithal, their own abilities, their own finite resources. And they wither away to nothing and take that rage and frustration out on others. When these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads because your redemption draws nigh. We have to have a relationship with God in the midst of the best of times and the worst of times, whereby we perceive the world through what he has to say, not how we perceive it. It should be the lifter of your head. Flatter me and I may not believe you. Criticize me and I may not like you. Ignore me and I may not forgive you. Encourage me, and I will not forget you. William Arthur Ward, encourage me, and I will not forget you. It has become so easy to minister to other people in this culture. So simple, so easy. And it really just revolves around one thing: encouragement. That God can lift other people's heads through the people that follow him. And that's how he tends to do it often. Are you one who lifts others outside of flattery superficial talk. Do you know how potent it is to walk up to somebody who's downcast and connect with them and say, listen, I've been watching you. I see the way that you mother your children. I see the way that you pour yourself into others. I see the way that you make an effort in the midst of all of the things that are going on in your life. And I just want to encourage you. I just want you to know that I see you and I value what you're doing and I understand what you're going through. And God is the lifter of your head. I mean, come on. People need that connection so bad. It's like water in the desert. Lift up your heads, O you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Psalm 24:7. People build walls. They use anger, frustration, criticism. They act a certain way to keep other people from getting close. And they act a certain way to create an unworthiness about themselves to keep God from getting close. Why? What are they afraid of? If you get close, you won't love them. And if God gets close and it doesn't work, they're doomed. At least they can hold on to the hope that they held them at bay long enough that it's not their person that's being rejected, it's their behavior. Yet you ask yourself why people act the way they do and keep people at arm's length as often as they do. And why are people so miserable and so ornery all the time? They're giving you a reason not to like them, and it's something they're in control of. It's not them, it's what they're doing. And they're two different things in their minds. And God says, I want to be the lifter of their head. I want to be the lifter of their head. I want to be the shield. I don't want them to have to build a wall. I want to protect them. I want to protect their hearts. I want to protect their thoughts. I want to protect their psyche. I want to protect their family. I'm their buckler. What heavy, cumbersome, protective door prevents the King of Glory access to our hearts? And every now and again, we have to ask that question. More importantly, every now and again, we need to answer that question. Maybe you're not going through some big, deep trauma right now. Great. I love it. I hope that's the case. But he's still your shield. And he still wants to lift your head. You say, well, I'm doing pretty good. No, you don't understand. You're missing the joy of him being the lifter of your head, not yourself. Well, I'm doing great. Things are going wonderful. I feel good. Yeah, I know that. But that pales in comparison to the and the but. The but is God can actually do that on a deeper level, a more weightier level, a more substantial level. He can give you a deeper peace, a deeper contentment, and a deeper mission, a deeper purpose in life. We don't want to be the lifter of our head. Even if it brings us to a place of contentment, we want God to be the lifter of our head in a context of a relationship, because when he does that, it means more. It matters more. It's weightier, and it's more influential in other people's life. The church is not the place for only people who are going through drama and trauma. It is. But it's for everybody to connect with and to be with he who is a shield and the lifter of our head. As our worship team comes back, I want to ask you to pray for some people whose heads need lifting, who are no doubt in the middle of a crisis, who didn't ask for it, didn't expect it, and didn't expect it so soon. And the day will come when somebody stands up here, me or someone else, and they refer to you in a similar situation. And what will you want more than anything? Those around you who care to pray for you. Crystal Green just lost her father. Paula Van Hoogen. Not looking good for her husband, Neil. Not looking good. In her own desert called Piedmont Hospital. In another city away from the people that she loves and knows. And God needs to be the lifter of her head. I'm headed to Scotland tomorrow. Why? To formalize our partnership and spy out the land. I have 11 speaking engagements. I'm meeting with people that are in charge of mental health in Scotland. people who understand they can't keep up with the tide of depression and addiction that's sweeping through their country, ravaging their marriages and families, and leaving them without a shield, despondent and discouraged. We need some good word, some encouragement, something substantial in life on a daily basis that says, God is the lifter of your head. I don't want to make a big flamboyant deal out of it, but I want to open our altar today for people who need encouragement and those who need to be an encouragement to those around them. There are people that are really, really in pain in this community, and you know what? You might be the only link they have to some sort of hope. It's up to you. You're it. You got picked. Do your job. Do what you're called to do. But don't do it on your own. Come to the altar. Ask Him to help you. We need some breakthroughs in people's lives. There's too many people that kill themselves on this mountain. And there's too many people that overdose on this mountain. We need to be prepared. I want to open this altar to those who just want to come and pray quietly. The prayer team, come and stand behind them and pray for them as well. Let's just take a couple of minutes. Life's too hectic. Let's slow down just for a few minutes and let's ask God to help us to grow, shall we?